John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, December 8th, 2011. A prominent rabbi appeared in court over allegations of sexual abuse of students under his guidance, and shepherds are attacked by armed extremist settlers just outside of Nablus. These stories and more coming up, so stay tuned. The Palestinian News and Info Agency reported Thursday that two Palestinians were killed and several others, including school students, were wounded when the Israeli Air Force fired a missile at a Palestinian car in Omar al-Mukhtar Street in Gaza City. The bodies of the two slain Palestinians were severely mutilated and were moved to the morgue at a local hospital, and they have not been identified at the time of this report. Israeli daily Haaretz reported that a prominent Zionist rabbi was sent to the magistrate's court in Jerusalem on Wednesday, facing charges of sexual assaults against two students who sought his spiritual support. Rabbi Elon is regarded to have been among the spiritual leaders of religious Zionism, and also served as the head of the Hakotel Yeshiva, a Jewish religious school in Jerusalem. The rabbi is believed to have committed sexual offences against two 17-year-old male students who went to his office seeking support. The rabbi went to court on Wednesday, accompanied by his wife, seven of his children, and other relatives, and maintains his innocence. In February of 2010, a rabbinical forum in charge of preventing sexual abuse in Jewish religious schools and communities issued a statement accusing Elon of sexual misconduct. Elon was dismissed from his position. Investigators submitted a file to the prosecutor's office last January, and he was indicted on November of this year. Head of the city council in Jerusalem, Nir Barkat, has ordered the closure of the historic Al-Mahaba Gate Bridge in East Jerusalem under the pretext that the bridge is unsafe. A month ago, the chief engineer of the Jerusalem municipality ordered the bridge to be demolished, but Jordan and Egypt intervened and convinced Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to avoid the decision, as such an act would ignite a new wave of violence in Palestine or the Arab world. Israel tried to coordinate the move to replace the wooden bridge with Jordan and Egypt, but the two countries rejected the idea and transferred the issue to the Arab League, which in return lodged a campaign against the act to the UNESCO. A group of extremist Israeli settlers opened fire today at a group of Palestinian shepherds tending their sheep in the eastern hills of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Four armed settlers approached them near the village of Yanun and opened automatic fire upon them. The shepherds took shelter from the bullets and no one was harmed in the attack. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, December 8th daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope that you'll join us again tomorrow. This has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, William Gibson.
Afghanistan, Saturday. NATO is reporting the deaths of three soldiers of unreported nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Kabul, Afghanistan, Tuesday. Afghan officials say 48 people were killed in a suicide bombing targeting Shiite worshippers. The Kabul attacker blew himself up in the midst of a crowd of men, women, and children gathered outside the Abu Fazl Shrine to commemorate the 7th century death of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. This sectarian attack has stoked so much anger that even the Taliban has denied all responsibility for it. Some are blaming forces based in Pakistan for this deadly attack. Pakistan, ongoing. The Pakistani blockade of U.S. supply routes into Afghanistan has reached day 13 in response to a U.S. airstrike that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers at a border post. Long lines of trucks bound for U.S. forces are stalled in the closed crossings, while U.S. forces are forced to reroute supplies to other nations like Uzbekistan. Pakistan, as of the 5th of December, Pakistan's commanders in the Afghan border region can now return fire if under attack without waiting for permission, Pakistan's army chief announced on Friday. Let's see how U.S. warplanes like being shot back at while bombing people. Baghdad, Iraq, today. Two mortars landed into green zone at dawn and casualties or damages have not been determined so far. An official of the country's interior ministry confirmed the attack, which could be heard at Xinhua News Agency's offices on the bank of the Tigris River. Iraq, Sunday. Prime Minister Maliki now claims he was the intended target of the car bombing inside the Green Zone last week. Kirkuk, Iraq, yesterday. Two mortar rounds landed near a Shiite mosque where pilgrims were gathering to commemorate a major religious ritual, killing one civilian and wounding eight, including a policeman, according to police. Iraq, ongoing. All U.S. forces are supposed to be out of the country in 23 days. U.S. forces are paying tribal warlords for protection of huge convoys departing the country on Highway T6, the road to Kuwait. Mr. Barack Obama, U.S. troops are leaving Iraq a more violent place than what they invaded after more than 8 years of war. What makes you think Afghanistan and Pakistan will be any different? Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home from all the wars, today.
A confluence of recent events has dramatically increased tensions between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Western nations. The early November release of an International Atomic Energy Agency report, presenting evidence that Iran had been developing a nuclear warhead over the past decade, while also working toward long-range missile capability, provoked calls for more severe economic sanctions. A massive explosion at an Iranian solid-fuel missile testing site on November 12th, destroying the facility, has prompted speculation that this blast, and another at a uranium conversion facility in Isfahan, could have been the result of a U.S. or Israeli covert sabotage operation. The November 29th Iranian student invasion and trashing of the British embassy in Tehran moved relations between the two nations to the breaking point. The embassy incident was followed by reports on December 4th that Iran had shot down a sophisticated U.S. stealth reconnaissance drone over Iranian airspace. In response to these events and the reported earlier assassination of four Iranian nuclear scientists and a computer virus attack on the nation's uranium enrichment program, Iran's Revolutionary Guard announced that they have raised their readiness level to confront potential external airstrikes and covert attacks. While Iran has long maintained that their nuclear research program is for civilian energy production only, both the U.S. and Israel have in the past threatened to launch airstrikes to derail what they believe is a drive to build nuclear weapons. Your reporter spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy, who assesses the risk of a military confrontation between Iran and the West as the U.S. presidential election campaign moves into high gear.
In analyzing particular events, there's a lot we don't know. You know, there's an explosion in Iran. Why was there an explosion in Iran? Who knows? Could have been an accident, as the Iranian government itself is saying. Could be the result of an Israeli or U.S. Covert operation. We don't know. Tensions have been increasing. The Senate just passed on a vote of 100-0 last week, legislation requiring the president to impose broad sanctions on Iran's central bank. This is a major escalation of the sanctions. Remember that at the beginning of this conflict, there were sanctions on Iran's nuclear program. Now, the Senate, under the leadership of Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois, who introduced this amendment, now the Senate is really pushing for attacking Iran's whole economy. And Senator Kirk has been quite explicit that his goal is to destroy the Iranian economy, make the Iranian people suffer. That's his goal. So this is a major escalation. We've got a Republican presidential campaign going on now, and some of the candidates, particularly the former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, has been very aggressive in his rhetoric about Iran, talking about a military buildup, having a military option with Iran. And this is also happening in a context where we, again, as we've seen so many times before, in the run-up to the International Atomic Energy Agency's report, there were again threats from Israel to attack Iran. This is a pattern. It seems every time the issue of Iran's nuclear program is on the international table, then there are these threats that Israel will attack Iran. And it seems clear that, and in fact this is often openly stated, that the Israeli government's goal is to pressure Europe in particular to agree to whatever sanctions are being proposed. And so the Europeans, in a way, that are being threatened, not Iran, by Israel's military threat, because, of course, there would be significant economic and political collateral damage for Europe, in particular, also the United States, as the Obama administration said, if the Israeli government were to attack Iran militarily. The Iran could respond by closing the Straits of Hormuz, for example, through which the majority of the world's oil passes. This would be a huge disruption in the world economy at a time when, you know, already the world economy is quite fragile. So, yes, there is an escalation going on, not just in the present, but with some indications about possibilities in the future. You know, imagine if Mitt Romney becomes the president of the United States in January 2013. Would we see a war with Iran? Would be more likely to see a war with Iran then? Many of Romney's advisors are people who served early in the Bush administration and were cheerleaders for war with Iraq. So, yeah, there are a lot of troubling signs with respect to the potential for military conflict with Iran.
Are there actors within the Obama administration that will do their best to avoid a military conflict with Iran going into this very dangerous year of saber-rattling around the U.S. presidential election? Or do you think the country could find itself in a new conflict in Iran in the next 12 months?
Well, I think both those things are true. I think that the administration does not want war with Iran and is not trying to push the U.S. towards war with Iran, and instead is trying to pursue this policy of sanctions and, you know, possibly covert action on Iran's program. However, those policies are dangerous in the sense that the more you escalate the sanctions from, you know, narrow sanctions to broad sanctions that are really attacking the economy, And the more you do things, I mean, you know, who's exactly doing this, but whether it's the Israeli government, the U.S. government, but things like assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, the more things you do like that, the more you run the risk of an Iranian retaliation, which then might provoke U.S. or Israeli retaliation, and so on and so forth. So these things could escalate out of control, even if it's not the goal, which I don't think it is, the goal of the Obama administration to have a war with Iran, but it is the goal of the Obama administration to dramatically increase pressure on Iran, possibly with the goal of regime change.
Robert, along with conservative politicians in this country that want to use foreign policy issues as a cudgel to beat up Barack Obama in advance of the November 2012 election, there is some thought that the Iranian hardliners benefit in some way from confrontation and even airstrikes or attacks on the country, in that the nation is quite divided in terms of a lot of opposition to the mullahs and the fundamentalist government there, and that an attack on the country would stoke nationalism and distract people from any kind of internal dissension going on?
Well, I think there's no question that escalation in the external confrontation benefits hardliners in Iran and benefits the government at the expense of civil society and democratic space. And this trend is well known. I think it's not an accident, and many people think it's not a total coincidence, that the protest movement in Iran in 2009 happened in a context where there had been a de-escalation. So the beginning of the Obama administration, Obama came in talking about diplomacy with Iran, made some positive gestures. People in Iran stopped believing that the U.S. was going to attack, or the attack on the U.S. was imminent. That increased political space because it decreased the ability of the government there to rally people against the threat from the United States. Just the escalation of the climate of confrontation constricts the political space in Iran.
That was Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy. Find more analysis and commentary about the rising tensions with Iran on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It's been a little over 10 years since the 9/11 attacks on the U.S., but new legislation now making its way through Congress has the imprint of similar bills that were hastily passed and signed into law in the fearful days following the nation's most deadly terrorist assault. The House and Senate have recently voted to include a provision in the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act that mandates that all accused terrorists be indefinitely imprisoned in military rather than in the civilian court system. But most alarmingly, the measure also empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens suspected of engaging in terrorism without charge or trial. Although many civil libertarians have been critical of President Obama for not thoroughly repudiating many of the Bush administration's harsh extra-constitutional methods of dealing with terrorism suspects, the White House, along with the Secretary of Defense, the directors of the FBI, CIA, and National Intelligence, have all publicly come out in opposition to the indefinite detention provision, saying that they are both harmful and counterproductive. But some observers believe the Obama administration's objections have more to do with preserving executive branch power rather than opposition to the substance of the legislation. Your reporter spoke with Chris Anders, senior legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, who explains why his group is opposed to the indefinite detention legislation and are urging President Obama to veto the measure.
This is an amazing bill, and unfortunately a bill that's on a very fast track, going back to both houses of Congress and being sent to the president's desk. Here's what's in it. There are a couple of provisions in it, in the bill, that allow for the indefinite detention without charge or trial of people picked up far from any battlefield. And this would be the military being the ones who would be imprisoning people. And it's so extensive and so broadly written that it even applies to people picked up within the United States. It even applies to United States citizens. And so the result of this could be, and it could very well be, that within the next few weeks, this president, any future president, could have the power to to order the military to indefinitely detain, imprison American citizens and others picked up here in the United States, picked up in friendly countries like Canada, Great Britain, elsewhere, put them in military prisons without any charge or trial, based on suspicion alone. And so it's basically anyone that would be suspected of having any kind of relationship with a terrorist would be able to be put into military detention without charge or trial.
We have seen President Obama take onto himself extraordinary powers, where he's ordered the assassination of a terrorist suspect in Yemen, al-Awlaki, just over the last month or two. And there have been other targeted assassinations abroad. How does President Obama's current power, which he accords himself, relate to this legislation? I would imagine it strengthens his hand to do exactly what he's been doing all along and that George Bush before him did. But it's interesting that his administration is opposing this legislation.
Yeah, well, one of the things that the Obama administration has said repeatedly throughout this year is that they believe that they have all the detention authority that they need. And certainly they've claimed a lot of detention authority, a lot of authority to do a lot of things around the world that a lot of people, and certainly we at the ACLU, believe that they should not be doing. The difference here is two things. And one is that this broadens out who can be detained and implicitly also broadens out who it is that we're at war with. And it delinks the war authority from 9/11. So this is no longer about going after the people that committed that horrible attack on the United States. This is about going after terrorism suspects and people who support terrorism suspects and people who allegedly support terrorism suspects anywhere in the world, including within the United States. And that's a big difference.
Tell us a little bit about the motivation. Why is this happening now? It seems to have a lot to do with election year politics and posturing, especially, you know, among legislators who are up for election in 2012.
Well, that's a million-dollar question. Why now? I mean, certainly it's more than 10 years since 9/11. The United States is pulling out of Iraq by the end of this year. Combat troops will be out in Afghanistan. The government is trying to figure out, Obama administration is trying to figure out how to get out of Afghanistan. I think probably right now as quickly as they can. And Osama bin Laden, of course, is dead. So why now? I think that really it's a couple different things. And one is it's the Republican takeover of the House gave this a little impetus to get this passed in the House. They finally felt like they had the votes to do it there. But then you also have a couple members of Congress, particularly senators, who have two different worldviews. One is there are people that just view this as a good partisan issue, and they just want to try to embarrass President Obama or embarrass other people and try to say, well, you're not tough on terrorists if you aren't willing to lock up even American citizens. But then there's another group of people, including people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who have this view that the United States is at war everywhere and that the war on terrorism is not like war on poverty, where it's some kind of metaphor. That it really is a war, and it's a war everywhere and against everyone. And if you have that worldview, it kind of makes sense. Well, maybe we should start using the military in the United States. Maybe we should start using the military against American citizens. And certainly, why don't we start locking people up before they do something? But that, of course, is not the way the United States operates. It's not the way our Constitution operates. It's not the way we as a people like to view ourselves. And so it's a very dangerous worldview, and this bill is a real fight for the very soul of who we are as a people and who we are as a country.
That was Chris Anders, Senior Legislative Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. Find links to more information and articles on terrorism, the Constitution, and the rule of law on our website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. On the 1st of December, an Occupy D.C. march issued forth from McPherson Square, bound for a fundraiser for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. The fundraiser was a dinner with a minimum donation of $5,000 and a maximum of $75,000. 75 big ones. Managed to get to the third floor and deploy a sign there saying, "Housing is a human right." After about half an hour, protesters got word of a second Big Bucks fundraiser with many members of Congress themselves on hand to sell their services to the highest bidder. Protesters headed south for the second fundraiser into Hotel W.
Rolling in on the W Hotel.
All right, Ken!
Some of the protesters tried to enter the Hotel W through the 15th Street door, but just as a very narrow doorway, several cops made a dogged defense of it, and one of the protesters was knocked to the ground. At that point, protesters sat down in lines across both doorways, and although it was possible for the attendees who had paid between $5,000 and $75,000 apiece to get in or out of the fundraiser, they had to run a gauntlet of protesters to do so.
The Congress! This Congress!
Takes $5,000 to speak to!
Indefinite domestic military detention!
Without trial!
This is unconstitutional!
This is un-American!
This is wrong!
And somebody asked him, does the money make it taste better? $5,000 a plate? I don't know what you can eat that's worth that.
Congresswoman Donna Edwards from Maryland.
I'm Congresswoman Donna Edwards from Maryland.
I walked in and didn't acknowledge you.
I couldn't walk out and not acknowledge you.
I stand by the 99%.
In my district,
people who've lost their homes,
people whose income is below $50,000 a year.
The lowest median income in decades. It's not fair. It's not right.
And
it's time for us to occupy America.
Fargo Bank is a major investor in the GEO Group, a private prison contractor responsible for locking up thousands of D.C. residents. On the 2nd of December, Occupy D.C. swarmed out of McPherson Square and marched on a Wells Fargo Bank in Shaw, joining another community group already there.
They get bailed out!
We get locked up!
They get bailed out!
We get locked up!
Yeah, got another group already here.
This is a bad news bank. Don't go to this bank. They use your own money. They use your own money to lock you up. You gotta be a fool. You gotta be a fool to invest in your own jail cell.
I heard that.
Look, here they come.
At this point, Occupy DC, reinforcing the community activists already at the Wells Fargo Bank, tried to blockade the doors so as to close the branch. Security guards and police aggressively resisted the sit-down blockades across the doors, didn't make any arrests, but were aggressive in pushing people out of the way instead. All right, blockades in place. Security's out now. They don't like this at all. Ooh. That could have hurt somebody. Although protesters were not successful in blocking the doors to close the Wells Fargo branch, there were a lot of speakers out there for the rest of the afternoon from community groups reminding neighbors about why they shouldn't be investing in Wells Fargo Bank, a bank that uses people's own money to pay for the GEO Group's private prisons that thousands of D.C. residents have been suffering in.
We are here today!
We are here today!
Because Wells Fargo!
Because Wells Fargo!
In the GEO Group.
In the GEO Group.
A private prison operator.
A private prison operator.
The GEO Group.
The GEO Group.
Engaged in harsh treatment of prisoners.
Engaged in harsh treatment of prisoners.
Resulting in permanent physical and psychological damage.
Resulting in permanent physical and psychological damage.
To D.C. residents and others.
To D.C. residents and others.
This is an institution that runs such inhumane prisons.
This is an institution that runs such inhumane prisons.
That a Rivers Correctional Facility.
That a Rivers Correctional Facility.
Medical treatment for 1,300 men.
Medical treatment for 1,300 men.
Is provided by only one doctor.
Is provided by only one doctor.
It is unacceptable for Wells Fargo.
It is unacceptable for Wells Fargo.
To continue to fund and support.
To continue to fund and support.
An organization.
An organization.
That encourages imprisonment for profit.
That encourages imprisonment for profit.
We will not stand for this.
We will not stand for this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Of the men who are incarcerated at Washington, D.C., have to go to a privatized prison. 95% of the men in Rivers are out of Washington, D.C.
95%!
Washington, D.C. is directly affected by Wells Fargo.
Wells Fargo!
Several days, Fortunately, there were thousands of black veterans of World War I who still had their arms.
Ooh.
And they formed organized groups to go throughout the city to fight the racist white mobs that were attacking the communities. The white racist mobs regrouped right up the street and came marching down into Shaw, right down Georgia Avenue, 7th Street. And right at this intersection, hundreds of black men with guns faced them down, shot them, and that was the beginning of the end of the race riot in 1919. And so when we talk about 7th and T and the obscenity that has placed itself here, that is putting us in jail, especially putting black men in jail,
I'm hearing what's happening now here on the streets. We can clearly see how they're trying to dehumanize the women and men that are under the prison system. They call Hispanics illegals and put them in cages from Texas to D.C. and destroy their families. They put the black male face on TV and tell everybody that he is a criminal, like he doesn't have any influence on our black youth today. Sexual harassment is rampant within the prison system when it comes to women.
Yeah.
But it's being disclosed because they don't want us to make connections between the prison industrial complex and our everyday ATM transactions.
Yep.
Democracy starts in the streets. It is not in the pool. If we want our democracy, we have to take it. We cannot wait on the politicians to give it to us.
Barack Obama gave a speech in which he talked about legalizing prolonged illegal detention. They're going to make more money locking up more people just because they think you might commit a crime. You might pose a threat to America's security.
What would we do if we were living in 1830 and slavery was alive and well? What would we do in 1935 when the Third Reich is on the rise? Now, people will intimidate you and say, oh, those historical parallels are not. But look what's happening. Look where this is going. More and more prisons are being built. 10 million, 20 million people locked up, making all the products that we use every day for nothing. I mean, this is slavery. That's not hyperbolic. I mean, we got to see the future. Look where this is going. More and more prisons are being built. The internment, imprisonment, and torture of people has been wedded and locked with capital and with profits. Money is being made. The enemies have it figured out. Now we have to get organized and we have to get to a level of commitment that at least are at the level of our enemies. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to stop these things.
And at the very least, if we want to stop these pigs that are using D.C. residents' bank accounts to build jail cells, to put people from D.C. in, the very least we can do is not put our money in Wells Fargo Bank. Late on Saturday night, the 3rd of December, or early Sunday morning, the 4th of December, members of Occupy D.C. erected a People's Pavilion, which had they have time to finish it, would have provided shelter from the rain and the snow of the coming winter. In a matter of hours, the police showed up furious, setting a noon deadline to remove the structure. Protesters refused to comply with this demand. Temporary buildings are seen in permitted events on parks throughout Washington, D.C., leading to a siege that lasted until 9 p.m. There may have been as many as 30 arrests overall. Reports differ on the total numbers. The last arrests took place at about 8 p.m., The park police did not have an easy time removing protesters from the roof of the People's Pavilion. Police in the bucket trucks took reckless chances with the safety of the last two protesters.
They're chanting, "That is not safe. The police are putting him in danger. This could get ugly." You better not drop him.
Thank you.
real dangerous. You could really have an accident that way. You could really drop them. And there ain't no net on you. Damn. Lucky, lucky, lucky. That's luck, that's not skill.
The very last protester was named David, and it was said to be a David and Goliath struggle.
Here comes the bucket truck for the attempt. It's the last known defender. There's a ladder coming up from below. They're going to try to attack from two different directions. I don't know what they're doing, but people are chanting, that's not safe. Flag just got knocked down. Is that their rope or his? Still haven't been able to get him out of there. If he gets hurt, them banks better look out. Still there. Now what you gonna do? That is a warrior, man. That rope looks like a goddamn noose to me. Looks like something you'd use to lynch somebody. Do they have them?
That's why they mad at me going to take it to court. You know what I'm
saying? Going down.
If he saves you guys, you got her on record.
Looks like the bastard's got him. I don't know if he's up in the bucket or going down the ladder.
And she mad that he's going to complete it.
After Goliath finally beat David, it took another hour for the police to finally demolish the People's Pavilion. At about 2 p.m., Asantwa, a D.C. area activist, had this to say about the situation.
I support
the occupation!
The occupation!
Because it is in the tradition
against all forms
of oppression
and exploitation.
Even though
King were out here
in that house,
they
would arrest him too.
the 7th of December, in pouring rain, hundreds, thousands by some estimates, of protesters descended on the K Street area. It began with morning marches against lobbyists, including a lobbyist for General Electric and against Wells Fargo Bank, before it all came together in a massive 3 hours-plus blockade of K Street. Occupy DC literally pitched tents on K Street itself at 15th Street, Vermont Avenue, and 14th Street in an echo of the original plans of Occupy Wall Street before they were forced into Zuccotti Park on the first day. By the time it was over, 62 people had been arrested, yet Occupy DC went on to march on the White House against indefinite military detention, demanding that President Obama veto the bill funding the Pentagon containing its provision. Finally, they marched to the Supreme Court to protest a Citizens United case, that Supreme Court case that legalized unlimited corporate campaign cash in U.S. politics. Here's what things sounded like on K Street as blockades were being set up and traffic was stopped. March is even carrying a tent. They've split from SEIU up that way. They're proceeding forward to a target. And tents have been set up across 15th Street and K Street, just outside Occupy DC's encampment. Now check that out, the Occupy DC banner right between a pair of tents, right there in the middle of K Street and 15th. Now we've got an open top tent set up too, shelter from all this rain. Looks like K Street's going to be blocked for a while. Marching off to somewhere. Another blockade set up at Vermont Avenue and K. It's 15th on the south side, it's Vermont on the north side. K Street is now blocked in three separate places. Both ends of Park and a block down the other way. As a third barricade was setting up, somebody in a white car decided to ram Occupy DC protesters. Fortunately, this was at walking speed without enough force to cause any personal injuries. You gonna ram them? Yep. That's assault with a motor vehicle right there. Get a tag on this guy. Get a tag! Virginia! XVT 6524. That's the sound of sticks beating on a trash can used as a barricade to hold the car in position. One of the normal protest barricades. Reinforcements, people! Reinforcements! One person was knocked down, but this time without personal injury, thankfully. Up! Woman down! Woman down!
How's that feel? Just hit it. How's that feel?
Get him out of that car!
Guys.
We got people down the other way! And once again, the car escaped without even a ticket. The police, needless to say, were not concerned at all with this driver's conduct. Still, one driver ramming one barricade, knocking down one protester, does not reopen K Street, and the blockade went on. More barricades coming into the street. I see a newspaper box and a baseball bat, trash can drums back up, protected by some wooden barricades this time. K Street, of course, was under blockade because it is the traditional home of the lobbyists with the fat bags of campaign cash that buy off government in this country.
Revolution!
They call it politics! We call it politics! Politics!
Bullshit!
Politics!
Bullshit!
They call for contribution! We call for revolution! Contribution!
Revolution!
Contribution!
When the police started clearing K Street, they worked west to east. The first positions were abandoned, and a solid defense made of the last defense. When the police decided to clear the barricade at 14th Street, though, the first thing they did was to march horse cops through the crowd, and one woman was sent to the hospital after her foot was stepped on by a police horse. They charged their horses directly into a line of protesters that included people sitting down. Charging in on them?
The people united will never be defeated!
that point, cops started dragging people away. Protesters during the civil disobedience at the west end of the 14th Street barricade sat down in the streets. Took the cops maybe half an hour to clear that. That still left the protesters at the east end of the barricade. They lied down on the streets, in part to repair horse charges, and in part maximize the difficulty of the police in removing them. They were lying down flat on the street in the pouring rain. The cops dragged them away one by one. By the time K Street was reopened to traffic, it was about 3:30 p.m. K Street had been closed maybe 3.5 hours. And yet, despite exhaustion and being shorthanded by 62 people from the arrests, Occupy DC was still able to go back out, go to the White House and protest against the indefinite detention provisions of the Pentagon budget, and then go to the Supreme Court, still in the pounding rain, and protest against the Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates to all that campaign cash. 12 more people were arrested there.
California Representative Henry Waxman has served in the House for 36 years and says he's never seen such assaults on public health and the environment as are happening this year in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. Waxman, who chaired the House Energy and Commerce Committee from 2007 until 2011, is now the ranking Democrat on the panel. He says that this year alone, Republicans have introduced 170 bills to weaken environmental laws, especially the Clean Air Act. The latest is Bill H.R. 1633 that Waxman says purports to be about regulating dust on farms, but actually exempts major industrial polluters from the Clean Air Act. According to Waxman and other critics, the measure allows open-pit mines, smelters, cement plants, coal processing plants, and other industries to emit unlimited amounts of particulate pollution, which include arsenic, lead, cadmium, zinc, and mercury, among other toxic substances. During committee debate on the measure, Democratic members offered amendments to preserve the Environmental Protection Agency's role in regulating industrial pollution containing arsenic and other heavy metals, and the EPA's authority to control air pollution from open-pit mines. Both amendments were defeated by the GOP majority. The bill comes up for a vote before the full House during the second week of December. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Representative Waxman, who says that while he expects the legislation to pass in the House, he hopes the bill will be stopped in the Senate or by a presidential veto.
The Republican-controlled House has been the most anti-environmental in the history of our country. They have voted 170 times this year to weaken our environmental laws, and the Clean Air Act has been the target of the most attacks, with 61 votes to dismantle the act. This has continued the efforts to block actions to address climate change, to stop actions to prevent air and water pollution, to undermine protections for public lands and coastal areas, and to weaken the protection of the environment in dozens of other ways. This week in the House of Representatives, we're going to vote on a bill that's very popular because it's going to prevent the regulation of farm dust. And people who come from the agricultural areas say their farmers are scared to death that EPA is going to regulate the farm dust, which is so natural. People walk around or have horses or whatever they do on the farms. The only issue is, however, that EPA has insisted they have no interest in regulating farm dust. And that doesn't make any difference to the Republicans. They want to pass a law to prevent it. But the real underlying reason they want to pass this law is because they're also going to remove regulations from the pollution containing arsenic and other heavy metals, and to stop EPA's authority to control air pollution from open-pit mines. They don't talk about that, but what they are really going to do is to allow toxic pollutants are pollutants that cause cancer and birth defects and other neurological problems, and they're going to stop regulation of these dangerous pollutants from mines, smelters, cement plants, and coal processing plants. So this isn't just stopping EPA from regulating farm dust, where they don't even regulate farm dust and they don't intend to regulate farm dust. It's really not about farms. It's about letting industrial polluters off the hook. for cleaning up their pollution.
So the vote is coming up this week. Is it a foregone conclusion how it's going to go?
So far, every vote that's been on the House floor, the Republican majority has prevailed in passing the most extreme anti-environmental position. They even took a bill that came out of our committee and made it worse on the House floor. They struck the goal of having standards for air quality that would achieve health outcomes. And they struck that from the requirement of the Clean Air Act, which has been the essential part of the law since 1970. And this is just like so many of these others. They've passed the House, where the Republicans control the majority. So far, the Senate has not acted, and hopefully they won't take these proposals up. But nevertheless, Republicans have them ready to go if they can trade them away for something in the Senate and force the president to sign very, very bad environmental laws. But I hope they won't get away with it.
How can they force the president to sign a bad environmental law? He can veto.
Well, the president can veto, but we have bills that are must-pass bills. For example, before we leave this year, we have to pass a bill to fund the government for the next fiscal year. The president, of course, has insisted that we continue a tax break for Americans on the payroll tax. And Republicans say they want to do that. Democrats say they want to do that. There's a problem on getting the way to pay for that tax break, to continue it. And the Republicans are looking to see what they'll find acceptable. They don't want to raise anybody's taxes, particularly for the upper income. But in the whole mix of things that have to be done, they can slip in some anti-environmental provisions and see if they could get the president to swallow them, because that may be the only way we keep the government going. I don't think they're going to get away with it. I think the president's going to stand firm, but we've got to make sure that he does and make sure that the Senate insists that these kind of riders on the bills be dropped.
Henry Waxman, how long have you been serving in Congress?
I've been in the House for 36 years, and I've never seen anything like we're seeing this year, where there's no restraint on the Republicans' ability and desire to wreck our environmental laws that were set up to protect the public health. If we let arsenic and lead and other toxic pollutants go right to the public without using control technology that we already have available to us, we will be sentencing people to very serious health disasters, not just kids who have asthma, which is bad enough, but inducing diseases like cancer and other respiratory problems.
That was Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat of California. For more information on congressional debate over the deregulation of industrial polluters, visit our website at btlonline.org.
This song goes out to all you goons at Homeland Security, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and police organizations that are trying to attack Occupy camps all across the U.S. Rich takes it for his children and rags welfare reform. Let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. Rich takes it for his children and rags welfare reform. Let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too.